they are all trying to implement health measures, and they are doing that in different ways. So they're lobbying and they're trying to influence science. And it's all about creating doubt about how harmful their products are. For instance, Elke Monastery is very successful in creating doubt that moderate drinking is harmful. And they, for instance, say there are also good sides of drinking alcohol. It can be good for your heart. We also want to hear that story.
For decades, big tobacco companies have lobbied lawmakers, questioned science, and funded research that downplays the health risks of their products. And even though everyone knows smoking is harmful, that story is not over. Tobacco-linked companies are making billions from a new generation of products, like e-cigarettes and vapes, presenting themselves as partners in public health while downplaying any health risks. In our investigation, Irene van den Berg revealed how big tobacco lobbies regulators and supports research in ways that blur the line between independent science and industry influence. A year later, she saw those same tactics in a different place. This time, the product wasn't tobacco, but alcohol. As European governments move to introduce stronger health warnings about the correlation between alcohol and cancer, the alcohol industry mobilized. Lobbyists pushed back, questioned the evidence, and worked to delay or weaken regulation, using strategies that closely mirrored those perfected by big tobacco. To figure out how powerful industries continue to shape EU health policy, we're joined by Irene van den Berg. Hey Irene, thank you for joining us again.
Thank you, good morning.
And Irene, your story starts with an anecdote. You write about a Dutch lung specialist, Wietse van den Bos, who was working with a pharmaceutical company called Vectura. It's a British company that makes asthma inhalers. And in 2018, Vectura funded van den Bos's PhD research. Van den Bos was looking into the small airways of children with severe asthma. And at the time, that raised no red flags, but overnight, everything changed because Philip Morris International, which is a famous tobacco company, acquired Vectura, which meant that suddenly van den Bos's research funding was affiliated with a tobacco giant. And what van den Bos said about that himself, suddenly I was linked to a company whose sole purpose is to sell cigarettes, he said. That was really troubling. What does this anecdote tell us about your findings?
Yes, in this investigation, we found out, Mathilde de Jeu and I found out that tobacco companies are investing in medical products for diseases that are caused or worsened by smoking. So, for instance, the tobacco companies are investing in inhalers for people with asthma or COPD, or monitoring devices for heart patients, or even lung cancer medications. So on the one hand, they make money from selling very harmful products. And on the other hand, they are profiting from the treatments. And in this way, you can say they're creating their own market. So we thought that was very worrying.
And what did van den Bos do after he realized this?
Yeah, he was very shocked. And he thought about quitting with his investigation. But he didn't do that, but he talked to colleagues and he wrote a piece in a medical journal to warn colleagues that something like this might happen. But he chose to stay in his research because he already worked for some years about on his research and he didn't want to stop it. So that was his choice. But he has to live with the fact that he started his career, his PhD, with funding of the tobacco industry.
Yeah, would you say this story is like a one-off, or is it actually quite common for researchers in this field to have this issue?
We found out that dozens of scientists are working for the tobacco industry, and we also found out that sometimes they didn't know it, or it was during a research that the company they were funded by was taken over by the tobacco industry. So yes, it is a problem for scientists, because they could get in the situation without wanting it.
What can you tell us about influence on the research itself?
Yeah, the tobacco industry sets the agenda. They don't fund research if they're not going to make money of it. So you can be sure that they're going to profit from this research. And it can be from making their public image better or improve their products. And for instance, in this investigation, the scientist was investigating how substances are going into your lungs. And that is important for inhalers. But the tobacco industry can also use that information for inhalers and vapes. So they can also create a very harmful product with that knowledge.
And are there any known instances of where the tobacco industry really pushed for specific research outcomes? Or is it more subtle than that? Is it kind of them picking what to fund and what not to fund?
It's more subtle. They set the agenda and they are they know what science to fund and they are creating doubts or they are improving their products.
Yeah, and I mean, I can also imagine that it poses a bit of a difficult dilemma for doctors if on the one hand they do really have this good product in front of them that at the same time is funded by the tobacco industry.
Yes, we also spoke to doctors and it's a big dilemma for them. On the one hand, they want to prescribe the best product for their patients. And on the other hand, they don't want to help the tobacco industry make more money. So that was a dilemma for them. And there are some products, there is some lung cancer medication that for specific patients, and there is no alternative for that product. So they have to go to the product in which the tobacco industry has invested. So that's a problem. But I think also doctors have to be very critical about this. Because if the doctors don't prescribe products which are linked with the tobacco industry, in the end, tobacco industry cannot sell his products. So yeah, it's also, they have to be aware about this.
But if I were trying to frame this as from a devil's advocate position and say, well, you know, from the side of the tobacco companies, doesn't it make sense to, you know, as their core product, you know, smoking is starting to become less popular among Europeans, to slowly move into a different direction, open up new routes like, you know, nicotine pouches and vapes and other forms of nicotine delivery that are free of smoking or even earning profits from fighting smoking or mitigating its consequences. I mean, could you say that's an agreeable choice? What's the ethical dilemma in your view?
Yeah, the ethical dilemma is that they're not stopping with producing cigarettes. So they're expanding their markets in Africa, in Asia, and only in the Western countries where they know smoking is declining, they sell their new products. So they are worried about the markets in the Western world, and that's why they are looking for new products. But I think we cannot be naive about this because according to the WHO, the tobacco industry is the most deadly industry on earth. It causes 8 million deaths per year and it's still expanding the markets in Africa and Asia.
Is it that globally that the number of smokers is still on the rise?
Globally, it's declining. In the Western countries, people are smoking less. And although they are expanding their markets in Africa and Asia, I think they are worrying about their profits. And so the tobacco industry is worried about their future.
Yeah. And I mean, for now, Africa and Asia are still expanding markets. But I can imagine that at some point, we will also see a decline in the number of smokers there.
That's possible that in Africa and Asia, it will also decline. But then you also have the new nicotine products. So maybe they're going to follow the same tactics as they did in the Western countries. And then they're going to sell their new nicotine products there.
What kind of products are we talking about?
Yeah, you have vapes and e-cigarettes. And in other countries, you also have snus. It's a tobacco product you put in your mouth. And the tobacco industry states that they are less harmful than cigarettes, and that's their harm reduction theory. And they say that smokers can quit by using these products. But in the end, they're looking for new consumers because you see with vapes, you saw all kinds of flavors, like a lemon strawberry cheesecake. And you see that they are targeting teenager, not old smokers.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the first time I tried like a vape, and I don't think I even realized it was harmful at all. It basically just tastes like cherries.
Yes, yes. And it can be a step up to smoking.
It's not about quitting. It's moving to a new product that is even more profitable for them, right?
Yes, but their narrative says it's about quitting.
I mean, obviously, vapes and nicotine pouches aren't as problematic as smoking from a health perspective, right?
The problem is we don't know about the long-term risks of this new nicotine product. Tobacco industry was very successful in the narrative that they are less harmful than cigarettes. And so they are becoming less popular, and maybe even parents thought, I'm happy that my kid doesn't smoke and I prefer vaping. But yeah, we have to be aware that we don't know the long-term risks of those products. And even if they are less harmful than cigarettes, they still contain nicotine and toxic substances, so they are not safe. And another problem, as we just spoke about, is that they are targeting a new market, young people.
So you wrote this piece for Follow the Money, but then a few months ago, something caught your attention that felt all too familiar?
Yes, with Vincent Harms, I worked on a story about alcohol lobby, and I saw that there were a lot of similarities between the alcohol lobby and the tobacco lobby, because for instance, they were both trying to postpone and weaken health measures, and they were both try to influence science. So I saw the same story all over again with the alcohol industry. I think the difference is that the alcohol industry still has a better image than the tobacco industry.
I think it's really interesting because, you know, a lot of new research now suggests that there is really no safe level of alcohol to be consumed. You know, like even the allegedly beneficial glass of wine in the evening isn't actually that good for us, right? And also, I think the way we deal with advertising tells us a lot about how normalized the product is. You know, I still remember the days when football teams used to be called, you know, Austria Tabacco Salzburg or something like that. You know, we had sports teams with cigarettes in their names, and that's no longer okay. But alcohol advertising, you know, like the good old beer ad, is still something that is very present in our daily lives. It is not kind of, it's still pretty normalized, I'd say. You know, does that really reflect what science knows about alcohol, Irene?
No, it doesn't reflect that. Yeah. We know since the 80s that alcohol can cause 7 types of cancer, and it's not only alcohol abuse, but even moderate drinking. But the alcohol industry is very successful in stating the narrative that moderate drinking is less harmful. They are creating doubts about moderate drinking, so it doesn't reflect that. And you see the warnings on the cigarette packages. Actually, we should do the same if we think that helps. We should do the same on alcohol, because the alcohol industry is very successful in weakening health measures. For instance, a cancer warning on alcohol, they are creating doubt that alcohol, moderate drinking is harmful. And they, for instance, say there are also good sides of drinking alcohol. It can be good for your heart. And they are funding science that is creating doubt. And we also want to hear that story. So if we read a story, oh, alcohol is good for your heart, I think it's a nice message. And that alcohol causes cancer isn't such a nice message.
I also want to talk a bit more about the role of regulation on consumption. That plays a huge role both with tobacco, but it also plays a huge role with alcohol, obviously, you know. If you introduce, for instance, a minimum price on a bottle of liquor, then the consumption has been found to go down. Now, both the alcohol and the tobacco lobby have have been huge in terms of their impact on policymaking over the years. I'm just reminded of a story I experienced myself nearly 20 years ago. I was an intern in the European Parliament, and I one day heard this crazy story that there was a Swedish member of parliament selling snus, this kind of Swedish tobacco pouches, out of his office. And I walked up there, knocked on the door and said, "Is it true that you're selling?" And he was like, "Oh," you know, kind of shouting the MEP's name. And he came up to me and he sold me an entire roll of snus for a quite reasonable price, I must say, which was branded as Euro Snus. And it turns out that this MEP was connected to the effort of one Swedish tobacco company to allow Europe, kind of get a European Union-wide license to sell its product, because snus at that time and still is restricted only to sale in Sweden as the only EU country. So here you have this kind of link between the national interest and politics. You know, like some politicians will defend a tobacco company like the Swedish one just because it's a Swedish company. Some politicians will defend a beer brand or, you know, kind of alcohol producers lobby just because it's a national champion. That's just one of many lobby dynamics. But how exactly, you know, does that lobbying work? Irina, you looked at that as well, right?
Yeah, it works very professionally. They work on many levels. So you see, they work in Brussels and they have contact. The alcohol companies or their trade organizations have contact with MEPs and are telling about these stories, so that it's good for the country if they keep on selling some kind of products. And cancer warnings on alcohol are bad for the local wine producer. We see that they work in Brussels, and with the cancer labels, we also saw that they had contact on a national level, so with the Irish government. And when that they weren't successful in that lobby, because Ireland still wanted to have the cancer warnings, they went to Washington and they spoke there with the trade representative. And that was very successful, because in the end, Ireland postponed the cancer labels, and they said that they did it because they were afraid it might harm with the United States if there was a cancer label on alcohol. So what you see, they are lobbying on different levels. And for tobacco, there is an agreement. It's the FCTC agreement that people from the tobacco industry cannot have contact with politicians or people from the government. It's forbidden, and countries have signed that agreement, but there is not such an agreement for alcohol. So, alcohol lobbyists can have contact with all kinds of people. So they are organizing parties with wine, and they can talk about their products.
Successful transatlantic lobby.
Yes.
again in Brussels, I once attended a very nice event by the European Beer Consumers Union, which no doubt isn't funded by consumers themselves, but rather by industry. Very nice venue in Brussels. Everyone didn't only get to drink a lot of beer, but also take home a six-pack. I found incredibly nice. that said, the shameless lobbying footprint on that industry in Brussels is being felt quite extensively. They also use these narratives like saying, "Oh, you know, we represent small breweries and local wine farmers," when, you know, the reality of the industry is what you have a few very large corporations who sell their product all over Europe and in the entire world. And regulation in Europe would, you know, wouldn't it also harm their prospects elsewhere, right? I mean, it's...
Yeah, our research was about Heineken, for instance. And in their annual report, they said that a cancer warning label was a risk for that it could harm their profits because people might buy less alcohol. But that's...
Shocking, shocking.
Yeah. But that's the intention of a cancer warning label. So,
Is having people adequately assess the risks of consuming a product, and alcohol still carries this positive image where, you know, moderate consumption might actually be beneficial for your health. Well, that is not really true.
Yes.
So Alex was just talking about how national interests also play a role in this whole story. Is that something you also saw in your research?
Yes, I saw that also in my investigation. And countries like France or Italy or Spain were more opposed against the cancer warning labels. And you also see that alcohol companies try to lobby their national governments. So Heineken goes to the Dutch government when they want to weaken or postpone health measures. And they say, oh, it's bad for our business. And then the Dutch representative can go to Brussels and say, oh, it's not good for our big company, or it's not good for our wine farmers, friends maybe say. So yeah, we see that.
Well, and then to wrap up, so we've discussed the playbook of the alcohol and big tobacco industry today, and you were here on the podcast once before to talk about big foods, health supplements, misleading European consumers. And from investigating all of these big industries, what's a common feature that you see in all of them?
Yeah, you see that they are all trying to influence health measures, and they are doing that in different ways. So they're lobbying, and they're trying to influence science. And it's all about creating doubt about how harmful their products are. And you see that with tobacco, you see that with alcohol, but also with highly processed foods. And all of these industries are successful in doing this.
And what's the next industry on your watch list?
I'm not sure. Maybe pesticides.
Well, we'll stay tuned for that one. And we're looking forward to your next investigation. That's where we'll leave it for today's episode. Thank you so much for joining us again, Irene. We'll be back soon for another episode.
Thank you.
You've listened to the podcast of Follow the Money. Our watchdog journalism is funded by our members. Subscribe and support European investigative journalism.